You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Karen Lissigers, the director of the Revenue Watch Institute, and I'm pleased to welcome our guest today, the author Peter Maas, who is an extremely experienced journalist who's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, a number of magazines. He's covered wars in the Balkans and reported from Asia and other parts of the world, and has produced a new book called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil, which is a quite thorough, rather grim, but also delightful, at least for the reader, coverage of examination of the many of the issues that we at the Revenue Watch Institute concern ourselves with, the relationship between natural resource wealth, oil, gas, and mineral resources, and the political and economic fate of the people who live in resource-rich countries. We are going to have a conversation first about the book, and then we will open it up to questions and comments from the floor. Now, Peter, you... Perhaps I should start... I said this book is grim... And perhaps I should start with a quote. Even the skeptics will point out that even the best of remedies, administered in the right amounts, cannot turn a curse into a blessing. This is true. There is too much corruption inducing, economy deforming, conflict enhancing, fate altering value locked up in natural resources like oil. Cannot navigate the violent creeks of the Niger Delta or visit the contaminated mess of Ecuador's Oriente region without thinking that everything would be better if oil had not been found. And I should say that, as you can see from the book, he has visited all of these regions and many more, from Kazakhstan to Iraq. Say, everything would be better if oil had not been found. Well, it has been found, that's for sure, and exploited. But you call your book The Twilight of Oil. So you're suggesting that maybe the curse will disappear because oil, the era of oil will come to an end. But It will be a puzzling title to many, because we read every day in the newspapers about new oil finds in Ghana, new oil finds on the east coast of Africa, huge new finds in Brazil. Iraq has just negotiated its first big contracts and is projecting that it will be producing as much or perhaps even more oil than Saudi Arabia. So how can one talk about the twilight of oil given these projections and finds?
Well, those are great questions to start out with. And first, I just want to thank you and Revenue Watch for inviting me here. It's really an honor to be here. This is also a situation where I feel like I am, you know, the outsider bringing coals to Newcastle and explaining what oil is like, because this is a room full here of people who know a lot more about most of these issues than I do. But let me give it a shot here at this. The subtitle of the book is The Violent Twilight of Oil. And people have asked me about that twilight. Well, what do you mean? I mean, is oil going to run out tomorrow? I mean, people here know that's not the case. But when you consider, you know, when is it that the oil age truly began? I mean, of course, first commercial oil well found in America 150 years ago, exactly to this year. And then, of course, the real transition to us becoming us, America, the Western world, the global economy, an oil-based economy, was just before World War I. This is when people kind of trace it to, when Winston Churchill converted the British Navy from coal-burning to oil-burning ships. it's now about a century later. And if you take the most optimistic forecasts that the IEA used to have, and some of the oil companies still have, perhaps we'll be able to keep increasing output for another 20 years, maybe 30 years. These are the most optimistic estimates. And of course, the new ones and the skeptical ones are that maybe we're actually at the peak. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that, like, because we're at a peak of oil output, that the oil age ends. Because, of course, the peak remains for a while, and oil is going to remain a central fuel for us for not just many years, but for decades to come. But there is a transition that I think is underway. And a twilight doesn't need to be a twilight of an hour or two or whatever. When you're looking at 150 years between now and when oil first was discovered in commercial quantities in America, and 100 years from when it became really the center of the world economy, if you're talking about just another 20 years when oil will be the dominant fuel source, then I think you really are very much in the twilight period, particularly when the transition to other forms of energy or to other forms of living in terms of being more conservation-oriented, efficient, et cetera, particularly when those things take many, many years to accomplish. So I therefore kind of see it as actually an appropriate use of the word twilight when you consider the length of kind of the sunlight, as it were, period of oil being the dominant fuel for the world economy. I also, you know, I went to Saudi Arabia to look into this question of, okay, well, really, okay, how much fuel is there remaining? And this is one of the problems of transparency. And the transparency kind of work, particularly that Revenue Watch is involved in, is more involved in revenue flows from companies to governments. But there's another aspect of transparency, of course, which is how much oil is there underground? How healthy are the reservoirs? What sorts of recovery methods are being used in these countries, particularly Saudi Arabia? And so I went to Saudi Arabia to try to kind of get answers to these questions. And it was a, you know, kind of Alice in Wonderland kind of experience, because I was able to get a visa not because the Ministry of Oil helped me or wanted me to be there. I was able to get a visa because there were people in the Saudi embassy attached to the foreign ministry who said, okay, you know, you should go there. We'll let you go there. And when I got there, the Minister of Oil himself was furious that I was there. They refused not only to not let me interview the minister, they wouldn't even let me into the ministry. They wouldn't even let me kind of talk to an intern about anything. And it was only actually on the last day of my visit there that the minister's spokesman finally agreed to speak to me, but not at the ministry, only in my hotel. And it was a conversation that lasted for just 20 minutes, after which he basically at the end it said, look, you know, either you trust our numbers or you don't. And that's just the way it is. And, you know, I'm a journalist. And, you know, the kind of slogan for journalists is, you know, if your mother says she loves you, get a second source. And so, you know, if the Saudi government says, trust us, I mean, you need more than just a second source on that. And so particularly when I talked with a guy named Sadat al-Husseini, who was a former executive vice president for exploration and production at Saudi Aramco, he had just recently left the company, and he agreed to speak to me in Dhahran. And this was a man who was inside the industry at the very heart of it. And we had a really interesting discussion for several hours where he said, look, there is a real problem in terms of production in Saudi Arabia, and we just can't keep increasing it because we don't have the reserve base to damage our reservoirs if we actually try to. So I really do believe, actually, that the peak oil problem is actually a real problem. I don't know whether we're at it right now or whether we passed it a year ago or whether we'll hit it in a year or two or whatever. But it just seems pretty clear to me, based on the little evidence that's there and the fact that the proof or the disproving of the thesis could be done if only some of these producers released information, that there's really good reason to believe that, you know, peak oil and the twilight of oil is indeed kind of, if not upon us, then right in front of us. So I don't know if those kind of get at all of your questions, but some of them perhaps.
If oil wealth is associated with problematic governance, environmental conditions, corruption, poverty, as you certainly document in your book, will the transition phase from plentiful oil, when oil companies were actually worried about, and Saudi Arabia, the producing countries, were worried about withholding supply from the market in order to prop up the price, to a period when there will be genuine scarcity of supply and therefore presumably increasingly fierce competition for that supply as we see emerging economies moving into the same consumption patterns that the U.S. and Europe have long manifested, which means an exponential increase in potentially hydrocarbon fuel consumption. If one assumes that competition, as we phase out of oil and oil supplies, decline or peak, will that competition mean that the conditions in the countries you visited will get worse rather than better?
You know, this is a fantastic question because overall, you know, at the end of my book, I make what I hope is a strong and not grim case for trying to do everything that we can to move beyond oil. But, and that the countries that we're not the only ones that are addicted to it in the sense of like we need the oil, but these countries that provide it to us are also addicted to the sales of oil and their economies and their political systems are totally oriented around it. And it would be better, I feel, kind of in the long run for these countries if they were not addicted to oil in the way that they are, because it has caused so much corruption, because it has caused violence in some cases, because it has caused environmental damage particularly too. But there is a really good question in there, though. Okay, like in Nigeria, for example, and I went to Nigeria and I went into the creeks and you know, stayed in the creeks and you know, lived with these people who had nothing, living right across from a massive Shell oil facility that you know, was spewing natural gas flares throughout the region. And it was really interesting. There were people there who I'd go to, and some of you have been in Nigeria, I'm sure, and you get different responses from people there. Some people want, you know, the oil production shut down. They just say, like, it has just caused too much problem. But others just say, look, you know, we just want to be able to benefit from it. And then when you look towards the future, however, if, you know, the future is going to be one where, let's say, if we're successful here, we don't need as much oil as we did before. Or let's say the future is one where oil supplies just are more difficult to get. And the end result of that is that basically there's less revenue, let's say, for these countries that supply it to us. Then one can see how in a short-term situation this could lead to more violence, perhaps, because if there's already a war going on in the Niger Delta over the oil and the money that the oil represents now, if there's actually less oil coming out, or if there's less money coming in from the oil, then one could see that one of the responses short-term could indeed be perhaps more fighting over it. And so, you know, I'm not really good at kind of predicting the future on these things. And I think part of the problem is going to be kind of managing the transition, not just on our side in terms of like how well we adjust or how quickly we adjust, how quickly we develop alternative forms of energy, et cetera, but also managing the transition in the countries that are addicted to oil in terms of their need for it to provide them with revenue and trying to help them to make this transition in a peaceful way, because it could be in the short term more violent. It depends on the country. One of the things I said in the book, and this is with great apologies to Tolstoy, is that every dysfunctional oil country is dysfunctional in its own way. And this gets a bit at the resource curse kind of question, because I actually try to stay away now from using the phrase resource curse, because it's a bit like kind of, it's become a bit like pornography in the old kind of definition of, you know, you don't know it until you see it. It's up to everybody's definition. And when you say resource curse, what is it that you're actually talking about? Because are you talking about Jeffrey Sachs's kind of foundational study from the mid-1990s, which a lot of people have come along subsequently and found great errors in terms of the statistical sets that were used for it? Are you talking about, when you say resource curse, just an economic phenomenon? In which case, well, then how do you deal with a country like Iran, where actually incomes have risen, although the country is a mess? Is it also a political phenomenon or a political phenomenon that you're talking about in terms of a resource curse? In which case, one can talk and have very interesting discussions about what's happened in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, et cetera. Or are you talking about environmental consequences? And so, you know, these are all kinds of questions that were raised the deeper that I got into this subject. And so I found myself kind of trying to parse through all of the complexities of what oil does, what might happen if oil changes in terms of output, in terms of price, et cetera. And, you know, like the proverbial onion, it just kind of gets more complicated the deeper that you get or the more layers that you pull back. And it becomes even more complicated when you're talking not about the present and trying to understand the present, but, of course, what will happen in the future if you do X or if you do Y. So, you know, it's, I think the best that we can do is try to do what we think is necessary based on the information that we have now, and react as changes come, as they will, unexpected things happen in the future as a result of, you know, not just oil prices, but our consumption and our transition away from it.
You visited Iraq in the course of your research for the book. And as I mentioned, Iraq finally seems to be getting back to its traditional business, if you will, which for at least traditional back to the middle of the last century, of being a very oil-oriented economy. Now, we've seen the divisions and the fighting and the coups in Iraq's history. And there are those who think that this time around, that having a resumption and an increase in oil revenues to Iraq at this point actually can help them hold the country together rather than lead to deeper divisions. What do you think?
These are like wonderful questions, because the same question, actually, there's been some really interesting research that's been done on Venezuela. Has oil kind of helped Venezuela in the long term? In the last 20, 30 years, it's kind of been disastrous. But in the long term, what has oil done to the development of democracy and to growth in Venezuela? And there are lots of studies that can show actually that oil was helpful in terms of like consolidating democracy in Venezuela, which was a more democratic place actually in the 20th century than many of the other countries in South America. And so in Iraq, though, you know, you have an interesting situation where, sure, perhaps it can be a glue to keep the country together, but then also, you know, very likely it can also be a divisive force, because of course you have a significant amount of Iraqi oil reserves that are located in what might be Kurdish areas, and they would like to have and take that oil with them. And, you know, that's why the status of Kirkuk has become such a volatile issue in Iraq, because whoever controls Kirkuk basically controls the oil around it. So is it going to be under Arab control? Is it going to be under Kurdish control? And the answer to that question is one that could be resolved with more warfare. We don't know. And this is kind of like, you know, predicting the future, which is something that I find very difficult to do. My job, actually, is as a writer to try to make these issues real and understandable for people. Not to necessarily find the answers. If I can find the answers, great, and I do certainly have conclusions and all that. But my primary goal, actually, in setting out to write this book was not so much to, you know, I've got to find the answers, I've got to, you know, get the 10-point policy plans to chart our way and Nigeria's way to the future, but just to actually kind of bring the problems that exist alive and to the attention of people who really don't know or understand them. And that's not anybody in this room, okay? It's people outside of this room. It's people who are not involved in the oil industry, people who are not involved in the transparency world, which is really talking about the vast majority of people in America. And so what I try to do, therefore, when I'm working on this book and creating this thing, is, I mean, I'm reading all the resource curse literature, I'm reading everything Revenue Watch puts out, I'm reading all the Global Witness reports, etc. But what I'm also doing, and what is absolutely crucial, is going into these countries and finding people whose lives demonstrate the issues and the problems of oil, finding the places in the Niger Delta that represent visually the problems environmentally or politically or in terms of warfare that oil is created. And so that's why, for example, you know, if we talk about Iraq, the way actually that I write about Iraq, although there's a lot of politics involved in the chapters that I write about it, the book actually opens in Iraq, but it doesn't open in, you know, a political back room or anything like that. It opens in Firdaus Square on April 9th, 2003. And that was the day that American Marines arrived in Baghdad and took down the statue of Saddam Hussein. And it opens there because actually the Marines, because I covered the invasion, the Marines that I just by chance happened to be following to Baghdad were the ones who took down this statue. And so I open the book kind of with this famous scene, and I kind of use it as like a set piece of sorts to say, okay, you know, this is supposed to be a clarifying triumph, but obviously it wasn't. Why the hell were we there? And then in terms of investigating oil and its effect on Iraq and what its future might be, one of the things I just tried to do is go to the places and find the people who, if they can't tell me what it really means, whose lives can perhaps show it. And so I then, in the subsequent months when I was in Baghdad, you know, went to the oil ministry. I went to the oil ministry just like a day after the statue of Saddam Hussein came down. And quite famously, of course, again, the oil ministry, and this is in the aftermath of the statue coming down, Baghdad was being looted, it was aflame, it was just an anarchic, very dangerous situation. And I go to the oil ministry, and it is, of course, famously the only installation in Baghdad that is protected by American troops. They were circled around it. And so I go there, and this is how I open the Iraq chapter of the book. And there are a couple of Iraqis, there's a little crowd of Iraqis out in front of it, and they're kind of like tugging on my sleeve, and they're saying, look, the Ministry of Oil is protected by American troops. Right down the street, you have the National Museum, and it's being looted. Everything in Baghdad's being looted. All about oil, because the only thing the Americans protected was the Ministry of Oil. And so I use scenes like that to kind of raise the questions. And then I subsequently go on in Baghdad and go to the Dora oil refinery, which is just across the river from the ministry, and find out that actually that wasn't protected by American troops. And there was a very interesting situation there. And I just try to use these things to explain some of the issues, to raise some of these questions. And I, because my goal is really mainly just to keep people reading my book. And it's not to keep them reading it so that, you know, they'll buy a copy for their mother at Christmas time, although that would be nice too. But just parenthetically, when the book came out, before it came out, I sent my mother a copy of it, and she actually came out to New York before the copy arrived, and we then got on a plane ride together, and she was reading another book. I was thinking, this is not a good sign when my mother is not reading my own book. But in any event, but the point is to just get people to at least understand and care about the issues. And I found that one of the difficulties in writing this book was that some of these political questions of the future, some of these questions of the resource curse and how it operates, killed the narrative. And so for that reason, there's a lot of kind of wonky stuff that I've got in my head, and there's some of it that are in the footnotes, and some of it was in the initial draft of the book, the first few chapters I wrote, which my wife, who's also a writer, read and basically said to me, this is really boring. It doesn't. And I just had to kiss Joe Stiglitz goodbye, kiss Jeffrey Sachs goodbye. And, you know, there, Jeffrey Sachs is mentioned once in the book. And therefore, I kind of had to stay away from some of these policy issues, which, you know, are really, really important, but killed the narrative and did not kind of like go to the strengths that I thought I could bring to this whole project. Because it's people like you who can kind of do the policy investigation stuff in some ways much, much better than I can. Anyways, that's a rambling question answer, and I had no idea bringing my mother into it, but anyways.
Well, one reads the titles of your chapters, scarcity, plunder, rot, contamination, fear, greed, desire, alienation, empire, mirage.
Kind of grim.
Yes. One has to ask, since you, as you say, you worked very hard in your reportage and in your narrative to humanize the story and to really give the reader a feel for what these places are like. Did you not find a single bright spot in any of these countries or cases?
Yes, I did, and in the end, I didn't write about them very much. You know, Norway, for example, obviously is a bright spot, a famous bright spot. And one of the reasons, I mean, it's in the book, I mention it, but one of the reasons that I actually didn't go into it in depth is because I wanted to focus on the countries that have problems with oil and try to make people aware that, hey, there are countries that have problems with oil. And I also thought that Norway is such an outlier that its experience, though kind of useful for us and useful for people in terms of developing policies that might be implemented in these countries, was more of a demonstration of why these countries have failed, the ones that I focused on, than on kind of how they could succeed. Because Norway, as we all know, found democracy before it found oil, and that was absolutely crucial in terms of having, you know, open, strong civic institutions, democracy, where people could peacefully decide how the oil money would be used, and then could oversee kind of exactly what was done with it, and they could make decisions such as putting a lot of it into a reserve fund. cetera. And these were just conditions that, you know, don't exist in Equatorial Guinea, don't exist in all these other kind of new countries. Chad is another one, a famous example, of course, where the lessons of Norway, et cetera, were supposed to be implemented. And so, yes, there are happy endings, but they seem not as applicable to some of the unhappy endings that I saw as I wanted. And I also felt that in some of these cases, you know, famously UAE, for example, Brunei, if you want to throw Kuwait in there, the reasons that their success stories is quite simple. It's that they have a large amount of oil and very few people. And the lesson that can be, you know, derived from that is, well, if you find oil, get rid of your population, because, you know, that's the way that you'll turn it into a success, is by just on a per capita basis having so much oil or natural gas that it really is impossible for your people not to have their incomes lifted and for most problems to be resolved with money, despite however much money the ruling family might steal. There's still enough left for everybody else. So, you know, if I could do it over again, and I don't want to because this took 8 years to do, I would have a chapter on Norway, because people say, well, what about Norway? And I do mention in the book, but this is one of the struggles of being a writer, that it took a long time to report, but particularly to write this book. And there are chapters that I wanted that I just couldn't do also because I didn't have the narrative material. Texas is another one. I mean, I went to Texas a number of times, and Texas is in this book. Chapter that opens in Texas, in Odessa, Texas. I wanted to write a chapter just on Texas, on how Texas has been affected by oil. You know, in America, we think, you know, Dallas, the TV show, and, you know, Texans are very rich. But Texas, actually, when you look at it from kind of a resource curse perspective, you know, its health and education indicators are really very poor compared nationally to other states. And I wanted to look at this, like, okay, well, you know, do we have a little example of the resource curse? And again, using resource curse kind of advisedly here in America. But I just, even though I'd spent time there, I didn't have the characters, and I also didn't feel I had a strong enough grasp of the material of Texas history to do the job that I needed to do. And it was somewhat similar with Norway, where, okay, it would have been good to have a chapter, and I did actually start to write one, but it wasn't a narrative chapter. It was just kind of like explaining Norway and why it succeeded. And I just realized, here again, there goes the narrative. And I just had to kind of privilege the narrative sometimes over some hardcore information, because I just realized, too, that there's so many questions that I couldn't answer. I just didn't have space. I didn't have the material. I didn't want to throw too much at readers. I didn't want to have a Daniel Yergin doorstop of a book. So I won't say anything more about Daniel Yergin.
So if you understandably, well, discovered that it was hard to find bright spots, or that there were more dark examples than positive examples in resource-rich countries, at least those with substantial populations.
I just actually, this is a dialogue, so we can interrupt each other, whatever. Just one thing I wanted to say is that actually, we've learned the lessons. I mean, we don't even need Norway to kind of like know what to do, in a sense. We've learned the lessons, and that's why I went to Equatorial Guinea, because this is a country that, you know, found commercial amounts of oil and gas in the early 1990s, became an exporter just kind of like at the end of the 1990s, and the lessons were known to the World Bank, to the IMF, to the American oil companies, to, you know, the NGO community, to the American government. And I went there because I knew this is like a great kind of petri dish of, well, what happens now when a country gets oil and the world knows kind of what should be done? And, you know, the answer in Equatorial Guinea, as was also the answer in Chad, is that, like, it doesn't matter. You know, these lessons are not being applied. You know, American companies, American banks, American oil companies are funneling all this money to the dictatorship, and nobody's caring what happens with the money's put into secret bank accounts, that it's being used for bribery, et cetera. Does not matter. Political expression is just as repressed now as it was before. So that's another reason, in a sense, why the shining, wonderful examples to me were not central to my book, because even though we know what to do, we've failed, not just once, not just twice, but more than that, to actually implement it. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens in a country like Ghana, what happens in a country like Uganda, which, you know, again, kind of new countries in terms of carbon reserves being found there, and much better countries than Equatorial Guinea in terms of the development of their democracy and civic institutions. But we'll have to see really whether or not, you know, the lessons that have been learned can be applied in place. That's my interruption. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I was just going to say we have, you know, you mentioned Equatorial Guinea. We also have Timor. These are both cases of countries with a lot of oil and very small populations, but they aren't Brunei yet, or Abu Dhabi, or Qatar. And we may ask why. You say we know what to do. What is that, do you think?
Well, I think, and this is one of the things that Revenue Watch is involved in. I mean, transparency is absolutely key, you know, that we know that it's very important for revenue flows to be public, that they cannot be kept secret. And so we know to do that. Getting countries to do that fully rather than just kind of like signing on the dotted line but not doing it, that's kind of another problem. Equatorial Guinea is perhaps an example of that. So we know what to do that. We know that political democracy openness is absolutely crucial to kind of countries coming to an agreement nationally over what's to be done with their resources. Because if you don't agree, if there's not an open process, then there's going to be an aggrieved party, and that aggrieved party is going to stay aggrieved, and that will cause tension. And that's one of the reasons that, for example, in a country like Nigeria, you have a lot of problems over oil, who owns, should benefit from it, etc. In a place like Canada, in a place like Norway, in a place like the United States, for that matter, you know, there is a democratic process that resolves who owns the oil and how it should be used. So if you find oil in a country, you know, it's Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan or something like that, it's a difficult situation because the decision over who owns the oil and what's to be done with it is basically made by the government and by the rulers and not really by the people because it's not a democracy. So, you know, what we know is that we need to develop democracy as quickly as possible in countries that don't have it but have found carbon reserves. But how do you do that? Democratization, that's, you know, the age-old problem for governments and development experts in the United Nations and the like.
Is that challenge made worse by the presence of oil? To circle back to the curse argument, as you know, there are a number of scholars who would argue that there is no resource curse, that you know, Mozambique has fared no better without oil than Nigeria has fared with oil, that Central America has been as poor and conflict-ridden and corrupt as Ecuador, but without the oil resources. So is there another dynamic that we attribute to the presence of resource wealth?
Well, you know, there's really interesting resource, I mean, reports, investigations that have been done on that question. It's a lively debate. Michael Ross at UCLA has done a lot of reports kind of on the political impacts of oil and other resources of that sort, whether or not they inhibit democracy or not. And, you know, the answer is that it seems so. To prove it scientifically, to prove how much, that seems to be like really, really hard to do. But it also seems very hard to kind of find examples of countries that, because of oil, have become more open and more democratic, at least in kind of the very modern age that we're in now. So, you know, it's a kind of chicken and the egg situation, like which comes first, you know, oil and corruption or oil and democracy or oil and authoritarianism. And, you know, my impression from traveling around is that it's both. You know, Nigeria was going to be probably encountering a lot of troubles, regardless of oil or not. The war, the Biafran war, probably was going to happen whether or not oil was an issue, although oil was an issue in that conflict. So, you know, you can't say that, well, because Nigeria has oil, therefore it's messed up, and if it didn't have oil, it would have been a great, great kind of, you know, shining light in the world. But you can look at it and say, but the effect of oil has not been terribly positive there. But I think the deeper down you go when you try to kind of like, this shows the limits of science in some ways. This shows the limits of regression analysis, that actually it's very hard to kind of like drill down and say, aha, yes, I have proven here exactly the effect that oil had and the effect that oil didn't have. Because it's not just that there's no law that explains it, but even in one particular country, as we realize, countries are incredibly complex. When you try to, you know, implement just the smallest of programs, whether it's a transparency program, you find out, my gosh, this is complex, and there are things that are going on that you didn't realize, and there are interactions of forces that you didn't expect when you throw in a new element. So to kind of, you know, answer this very big question, you know, to what effect did oil affect a particular country? You can make statements about it, you can have guesses about it, but to actually kind of prove it scientifically is really difficult. And I just kind of do the best job that I can to raise the questions and to show that, look, as far as I can tell, based on the things that I've seen, and here are the things that I've seen, oil has caused a certain amount of problems in these places.
Some of the big multinational corporations have made efforts to clean up their act, so to speak, both to have more environmentally responsible production techniques, but also to be sensitive to the political and social consequences of their activities. Not just these corporate social responsibility programs, but more generally participating in the extractive industries transparency initiative and so on. And many of them are also bound by the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and parallel legislation in European countries. Even clear, those laws are not being vigorously enforced there, at least there, and there's always a risk to corporations that they will, in their case, be enforced. But there are some big new players on the scene, China being the most obvious and the biggest, both as not just as a consumer of oil, but also as an acquirer of concessions and offering sometimes very appealing packages of resources and infrastructure support and so on for countries that do have the resources China needs. Did you come across the Chinese presence in any of the countries where you did your research, and if so, what did you find?
Oh well, it was of course fascinating, and I don't want to harp on Equatorial Guinea, but it is actually a wonderful kind of petri dish of everything that goes on in the world of oil, in the world of transparency, in the world of geopolitics, because I went there in 2004, I think it was. And you can now go to Equatorial Guinea and stay at a Sofitel and pay with your credit card. But when I was there, you couldn't pay with credit cards anywhere. And I was staying in this little hotel, and it cost about, because there weren't that many hotels in Malabo at the time, about $150 a night. There are only two ways to pay my bill, either pay with cash or bank transfer to foreign bank account. And so when I went to the reception after a few days, I said, okay, look, I'm going to be staying here hopefully for a little bit longer. I ended up being expelled on accusations of being a spy. But at that time, before I got expelled, I did set up to pay my hotel bill. And they said, okay, well, you can pay us in cash or transfer the money. I said, okay, I'll arrange a bank transfer. What's the bank account? And they gave me a number for a bank account in Shanghai. And then all of a sudden, kind of like the light bulbs go off over Peter Moss's head, because the hotel is called the Dynasty Hotel. And the people behind the reception are Chinese. And the food that's being cooked in the kitchen is Chinese food. It was a Chinese-owned hotel. And also in my room, it was like a kind of artistic performance there, a replication of a dingy Chinese hotel room, but I was in West Africa, not in Shanghai. In any event, in Equatorial Guinea, American companies are, of course, the largest ones there. Exxon, Marathon, etc. They are the largest. They've invested billions of dollars. But when I drove out to, when I took a plane to Batan and drove through the kind of inner parts of the country, there was a road that was being built as I was driving on it, and there were Chinese engineers along the side of the road, and Chinese are indeed trying to get contracts in Equatorial Guinea, as they are throughout the rest of Africa. And so, this presence, the Chinese presence, was certainly very much felt by me. I saw it. I had to, pay money to a Chinese state-owned hotel company's bank account in order to stay in Equatorial Guinea. But I also, I think in some ways, were manipulated by it to an extent. I mean, there is this really genuine competition going on for world resources that apparently seem to be scarcer and scarcer as far as oil is concerned. But I think in some ways it's a race to the bottom that we're being manipulated into participating in. When I was in Quito in Ecuador, because I went there to go into the Oriente, this area that Texaco had extracted oil from, and it was being sued for billions of dollars for damages that it caused. I was speaking with an American oil executive in Quito, and there's an area in Ecuador in the southern Amazon where they haven't yet kind of extracted any oil, but where oil companies think there are a fair amount of reserves and they want to go in there, but the indigenous Indians are stopping them from doing it, until now at least. And this oil executive said to me, look, you know, I know that some of the indigenous people don't want us to go in there, and, you know, shareholders in America, et cetera, kind of, you know, don't want to see American companies going into these environmentally sensitive areas and extracting for oil. But here's the situation, Peter. You know, if we don't go in there, the Chinese are going to go in there, or the Russians are going to go in there. And not only does that mean that they're going to get those resources, but they're not going to do it as well as we do it, because we do have better technology. And this is, of course, very true. American technology is still far superior to everybody else's technology in the extractive industries. And they're also going to be paying a lot more bribes than we are, because they're not inhibited by the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And what this oil executive was saying to me applies to not just Ecuador and the southern Amazon there, but to all other countries. And it was true, certainly on kind of like a certain level, but I also felt that I was kind of being manipulated in some senses by this. Because, yes, there's a political difference in terms of the pressure that an American company will exert on a foreign government versus a Chinese one. But when you look at Equatorial Guinea, back to poor Equatorial Guinea, American oil companies have not really been, as far as I could tell, a terribly strong influence for democracy and openness. Yes, more of an influence than a Chinese company would have been, but I don't think it's like a significant difference that's changing the fate of the country. And, you know, I also think that the idea of like, well, because the Chinese or the Russians are after it, therefore we got to get there before them, I think that just dooms us to kind of repeating, and probably in a much more vociferous and violent way, what's been going on for the last century in terms of competition for control of resources. And so we kind of need to, I think, break out of that paradigm if we can and say like, okay, well, actually, the fact that the Chinese and Russians are going to get it if we don't get it, well, okay, fine. Yet another reason for us to move our asses to get off of oil as quickly as possible, or, you know, to conserve the resources that we have, et cetera, so that we don't get involved in this race for the bottom, which could be a lot more violent than the race to the bottom that we've been fighting for the last century. And that sounds like a political speech, and I try to not do that in my book, but I've just done it here.
I think that's a good note on which to open the discussion for questions, comments from the audience. The door is open. Please just walk up to the microphone. And
Masha Faganov and I run the Turkmenistan project here at the Open Society Institute. So another country that suffers some of the effects of the revenue curse. I wanted to come back to both of your points about the argument that the revenue curse perhaps does not exist, that some countries fare better, no better than the others, regardless of the absence of resources. And I buy that argument on some level. My question to you is, I wonder if the countries that fare worse, that do have large amounts of resources that are not well managed, do so not only because of the internal structure, but that the response that they get from the international community, whether it's the banks, whether it's the governments that might have influence on them, etc. So the country might be acting as naughty as it likes without anyone paying attention or without anyone criticizing it for its actions because it has large amounts of resources that someone else might have. So it's actually, it's not the internal dynamics on their own that influence how a country is developing, but also the reaction out from the outside, which is contingent on the resources the country has to offer. So just your reaction to that.
I think it's both of those. You're right that, you know, it's not just kind of internally how the country might exist at the time when it has oil or when it begins to extract oil or natural gas. Also, what the forces, what the companies, the governments that interacts with do or suggest. I mean, one of the ways that I tried to write about that, for example, and this is in your region, not Turkmenistan, but Kazakhstan, is, as probably a lot of you here know, there's a guy named Jim Giffen who in 2003 was arrested at John F. Kennedy Airport and accused of having been involved in about $80 million of bribery in Kazakhstan, sharing money that was diverted from oil companies to his own purposes and also into the pockets of Nursultan Nazarbayev, the president of Kazakhstan. Giffen had been actually the main negotiator on behalf of the Kazakh government with foreign oil companies, mostly American oil companies. So the Justice Department kind of in 2003 said, you know, indicted him for corruption, the largest FCPA indictment up to that time. And I wanted to write about this because this is kind of gets to the influence question. And what I did, and this is why this book also took so long, because I try to do too much, and most of the things I try to do don't pan out. I went in about 2004 to a process hearing for this case, and I got there early because I wanted to see if I could talk to Giffen or meet Giffen. And I knew, okay, he's been indicted. He's probably not going to want to talk, but what the heck. And so I go there. I go to the federal courthouse, and he's there with his four lawyers. And before his lawyers can kind of react, I go up to him and introduce myself, say I'm working on a book about oil, and I'd like to talk to him about this issue of, you know, corruption and the effect of foreign actors in the domestic situation as far as oil contracts are concerned. And he kind of nods and says, okay, that's interesting. But by then his lawyers kind of awoken and realize that their client is talking with a journalist. And they tell me, no, I can't talk to him. But then in the subsequent days, I talk with the lawyers and I say, look, you know, I really want to talk to your client and I'll do it off the record. I just want to talk to him about the case, not the particulars of it, but just what happens in terms of the influence of the American government and foreign oil companies on countries and governments in places like Kazakhstan. And the lawyers say, no, he'll never talk to you. We're not going to let him talk to you. And I just have to persuade them. I say, look, he's paying your bills. I'm not paying your bills. Just send him this email that I'm going to send you. Send him the stories that I'm going to send you and let him make the decision on whether or not to talk to me. And about 3 weeks later, my phone rings and it's Jim Giffen. And he says, okay, let's talk. But this conversation's not happening. Okay, fine. And so we talk for a couple of hours. And then at the end of which I say, look, there's still more to talk about. Can I come to your office? He's out on bail, $10 million bill. Bail had no trouble making that. And I go to his office. And I ended up going to his office several times. And in the end, he let me actually put some of this on the record. And I write about it in the book. And what I write about is that you go into his office and there are pictures of him with just about every American president going back to and including Richard Nixon. And the reason that Jim Giffen in 2009, after having been indicted in 2003, has not yet gone to trial, is still out free, is because he's mounting what's called a public authority defense. And a public authority defense basically is, I was working for the U.S. government, so therefore the U.S. government can't prosecute me for it, because Giffen's defense is, I was cooperating with the CIA and other intelligence agencies. They knew what I was doing. They approved of it because I was actually steering these contracts to American companies. And indeed, Chevron has the largest contract in Kazakhstan, and most of the contracts are with American companies, and Kazakhstan is trying to get its oil and natural gas out, not through Russia, but through other countries. And what this did for me was it was a really interesting demonstration of, you know, indeed, how kind of involved the American government is in, if not overtly, kind of sanctioning law shaving or illegal activities, encouraging them or turning the other eye to it. Although, and this is where it gets, America is just as complicated as Nigeria in terms of politics. The government's not a monolith, because the Justice Department found out about what Giffen was doing and, boom, indicted him. But other parts of the government were just not aware of what the Justice Department was doing and have opposed it, because the reason Giffen's not yet gone to trial is that the CIA and the other intelligence agencies are not releasing information to the court that would prove or disprove Giffen's allegation that he was working for them. So, you know, I think you're totally on the mark with that, and I've kind of gone all over the place in my response to it. But, we can't, however, just say it's the foreign companies, because one other thing to remember, I mean, everybody here knows this, fine, up until about 30 years ago, 85% of the world's oil resources were controlled by the Seven Sisters or their descendants. But now it's, of course, totally reversed, and most of the world's oil resources are controlled by national oil companies. So, you know, we can't kind of blame all the problems just on Chevron or Exxon anymore, because there are other players that are nationally owned players that are involved. And I just think that that's kind of, you know, another factor that we need to kind of keep in mind in terms of what's going on and who the influential players are. On top of which, just one quick final note. In a country like Nigeria, Shell obviously has been the focus of attention, and justifiably so, not just for what happened in the 1990s with Ken Saro-Wiwa and its involvement in that, but what continues to happen. I went into the Delta, and Shell's operations there are objectionable on so many different levels. However, as I think everybody here knows, Shell and all of the American oil companies, all the foreign oil companies in Nigeria, are basically in joint ventures with the Nigerian National Oil Company. So everything that these companies, our companies, do is being done alongside a Nigerian state-owned company and with basically the approval of the Nigerian government. So Syriana, the movie that probably a lot of people here saw, its kind of tagline was, everything is connected. And it was a very good tagline because everything in the oil world does seem to be connected in the end.
Yes, thank you very much for your presentation. I'd like to know, does the book include Russia and the effect of oil on its economy? And also, does it take in aspects of terrorism and oil? Thank you very much.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm Dr. Mildred Palmer. I'm president of Cinema Verite International, Inc. I also teach at John Jay. Thank you.
Yes and yes. And the longer version is, I went to Russia and I spent time with Vagid Alekperov, who's the chairman and chief executive of Lukoil, which is the largest privately owned oil company in Russia. And it was a remarkable kind of experience. And I kind of tend to just use scenes or symbols when they're particularly eloquent to describe political realities. And in the case of following around Alekperov, when I went into his office one day, I noticed that on his desk, he's got a beautiful office in the Lukoil Towers, and I noticed on his office, on the place on his desk where you'd normally see kind of the picture of his wife and his daughter, it wasn't a picture of his wife and his daughter, it was a picture of Vladimir Putin. I asked him, why do you have a picture of Vladimir Putin on your desk? And he said, well, Vladimir Putin is my leader and I respect him very much. And this was the only time that I'd seen Alekperov turn the least bit timid, because Alekperov is a fierce, tough guy who makes Texas oilmen look like, just wallflowers. And his office was also illustrative of kind of this deep connection. And this is where the chapter that I have on Russia is focused on it, the deep connection of oil and power to the fate of the country. Because not only was there a picture of Putin on his desk, but behind Alekperov's desk, you had the seal of Russia. And I kind of realized that if you just turn back the clock a little bit, the heads of the state-owned oil companies in the Soviet times would have had a picture of Brezhnev on their desk and the Soviet seal behind them. And even though Lukoil is shareholder-owned, it is effectively kind of state-controlled in terms of what it does and the interests that it serves. And one of the remarkable things, and this is where kind of resource curse reporting and research has become very interesting. Yegor Gaidar, who was the acting prime minister under Yeltsin and who kind of pushed through the first bits of the shock therapy programs in Russia, has really written some interesting stuff in recent years about the effect that oil had on the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because, the Soviet Union was going to collapse one day or the other, but the camel that might have broken the straw, no, the straw that might have broken the camel's back, Gaidar has written this and other people have too, is the collapse of oil prices in the 1980s, because the Soviet Union depended on the hard currency that it got from oil and gas sales in order to support itself, to feed its own people, et cetera, and also to support the satellites that it had throughout the world. And when oil prices collapsed in the 1980s, and there's an interesting theory that Reagan and the CIA were very much involved in trying to convince the Saudis to increase output so that indeed oil prices would collapse, because they realized that the Soviet Union could be brought down not with necessarily Star Wars, but just with $12 a barrel oil prices. And according to Gaidar and others, indeed, the collapse of oil prices, the collapse in revenue, and also there was a collapse in production that was going on because the Soviet economy was just falling apart, that this is actually the straw that broke the back of the Soviet Union. And when Gorbachev came to power, he just did not have the financial resources that he needed and that the Soviet Union had depended on in order to push through the reforms that he was trying to do. So, yes, Russia's in my book. And it's one of the places, one of the things I just to add, it's... Karen had asked me about this beforehand, about local journalists, and kind of if I work with them, if I talk with them? And the answer is yes. For the work that I do, you know, when I go to these countries, Russia's kind of an exception because I speak good broken Russian. I studied it in college. But in most of the countries I go to, I don't speak the language. And I end up working with local journalists who I hire as my fixer, interpreter, whatever. And they're absolutely essential to the work that I do. So in terms of so many of these interviews and experiences that I've had, there is a local journalist usually by my side without whom, A, I would not be there, I would not get the information, and I might not even survive. And these guys are absolutely crucial. Why does this keep cutting out? Anyways.
Just I want to on the question of the collapse of the oil price and the collapse of the Soviet Union, I can say with considerable confidence that I very much doubt that the U.S. policymakers made the connection between the impact of oil prices and Russia's and the survivability of the Soviet empire. I just don't think there was that much subtlety in our policy making, and I've been in government. And I'm not saying that was just the Republican administration. I'm sorry to say, I think
you could
true.
Be. All that I know but about that is that, that Peter Schweitzer wrote a book, and he's kind of a conservative pro-Reagan type person. He wrote a couple of books and came out in the last 10 years about this issue, and he claims that William Casey, the head of the CIA in the Reagan era, kind of was aware of that and was pushing that with King Fahd on a direct level, but that other people in the government weren't necessarily thinking that at all. And, you know, the American pressure, if it existed, isn't necessarily what led to the increased Saudi production, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just kind of pointing to the sources that I use for that little
other
bit.
Toward the second half of the 80s, the other parts of the Bush administration, including the president, encouraged the Saudis to withhold supply in order to push up the price, both because the low prices were so damaging to Saudi Arabia, it was also damaging to the Texas oil economy, suspected. Yeah. At a minimum, there were mixed. Anyway, Tom, you had a question?
You said, with apologies to Tolstoy, that all dysfunctional oil-producing economies are dysfunctional in their own way. I want to sort of ask a follow-up on that particular point to ask if there aren't at least some generalities or some sort of common characteristics that can be pulled out from your vast research beyond the level of, you know, non-democratic and non-transparent. Are there some common themes there at a slightly, you know, less abstract level? And if so, what are the lessons that can be learned from those?
You know, it is really hard to talk about commonalities because the first thing that pops to my mind is Dutch disease, okay? And I think most people here are aware of the Dutch disease. It's the notion that when you have kind of like a wave of foreign currency that's coming in from natural resource sales, what happens is the local currency appreciates, and so therefore it becomes less expensive for domestic consumers to buy foreign goods, and it becomes more expensive for foreigners to buy the domestic goods produced by your farmers or by your manufacturing industry. The result of that, you know, your manufacturing, your farming industries atrophy, collapse, which happened temporarily, at least, in the case of the Netherlands in the 1970s when natural gas revenues kind of began coming into the country. And that's something that seems to be a peril for a lot of countries, but not all of them necessarily. I mean, there's been really interesting research that's come out about Nigeria, that actually Nigeria didn't necessarily or hasn't necessarily suffered the Dutch disease problem so much because actually not that much money entered the Nigerian economy as a result of its oil sales because so much of it was kept overseas due to corruption. And actually just overall, actually Nigeria, though, has a lot of oil, has so many people that the effects of the currency inflows wasn't quite as large. But it does seem to be a peril for a lot of different countries. Venezuela seems to suffer it fairly significantly. I think other countries do too. I think a big cross kind of country problem is unemployment. Now, you know, unemployment is a problem in kind of all Middle East countries anyways, ones that have oil, ones that don't have oil. But it's, you know, a particular kind of paradox and problem when you have in a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, or you've got it also in Venezuela, et cetera, and Nigeria, of course, and, you know, we can keep going on, Iran too, really high levels of unemployment. And one of the ways that this...
What's the spell of unemployment?
Well, the oil industry, which becomes the center of a country's economy, doesn't provide jobs. You know, that you have kind of government revenues and kind of government activity centers around this sector that doesn't create employment. I mean, it's Saudi Aramco, okay, the largest oil company in the world, presiding over 264 billion barrels of oil, employs about 50,000 people directly. I mean, of course, it has subcontractors, et cetera, but 50,000 people it hires. When I visited Saudi Aramco, the company was actually very willing to talk to me. The ministry would not. So I could talk about certain economic matters with the company, but the ministry was quite obstructive. They told me they hire about 500 engineers a year. 500. That's nothing. In a country of that size, 25 million people or whatever. When I went to Equatorial Guinea, and again, I have Equatorial Guinea on the brain. This is going to be diagnosed in the next DSM probably. I went to a Marathon was building a natural gas facility, which is now operational, and it's a $2 billion natural gas facility. And the construction site was quite amazing because there were about 1,500 workers there, and the bosses, the engineers, were all Texans or Oklahomans. But the workers themselves were not from Equatorial Guinea. They were all from India. They were from the Philippines. And the reason that they were from these other countries is because the kind of construction supervisor explained the whole thing to me, and it's not news to any of you here. But it was much more economically efficient for the company to bring in these guys who had previously worked on major construction projects, who knew how to weld, who knew how to drill holes and all that kind of stuff. And it also was more economically efficient for the company to just bring in all the food, house the workers, and bring in prefab units on the construction site for them to work at. And when I was driving down around this construction site with the manager, we were on this dirt road that was kind of delineated by rocks that were painted yellow. And I said to him, well, what about the paint? And he's like, we imported that. What about the rocks? And he's like, well, those are local rocks, but it would have been cheaper for us to import them. And the thing is, I described this again. I kind of like, to just describe this phenomenon in kind of like an economics textbooks would, you know, be the easiest thing, economic textbook way would be the easiest thing to do. But and I wouldn't do that unless I had this kind of scene, because then I can just describe it in this way. But it showed to me that, you know, this massive multi-billion-dollar facility could have been on the moon for all of the kind of local impact it had beneficially in terms of employment and in terms of also kind of like generating economic activity. Lumber was being imported rather than used from the forests that were right next to the construction site. And, of course, as we know, these facilities, once they're up and running, I mean, they're incredibly high-tech, capital-intensive. You just need 100 engineers or something like that to run them, and you're off to the races as far as Marathon is concerned. So I think the unemployment thing is a huge, huge problem when you have a government's economic activity and a government's attention and resources focused around a sector that does not create jobs, you know. So that's a very long answer to your question.
We have a question there and a question here, and that's...
Hi, I'm Jimmy Herrera from the U.S. Programs. Could you please expand a little more on your idea of democracy in Venezuela and oil?
Oh, I'm scared of doing that. You know,
in
I can't.
1 minute or less.
Yeah, in 1 minute or less. You know, it's a great question, kind of like what effect oil has had on democracy in Venezuela if you're looking at, like, you know, from the 1920s onwards. And I can just say that there are interesting studies that show that oil had a positive effect on economic growth and democracy in Venezuela up until about the 1970s, when prices went way up and everything kind of became destabilized. In terms of Chavez and democracy there, there's a saying in Venezuela which applies, I think, to every other oil-producing country, which is that in Venezuela, there are not good presidents and bad presidents. There are presidents at times of high oil prices and presidents at times of low oil prices, which is one of the reasons why, you know, Chavez and Putin were incredibly lucky. They both came to power at times of incredibly low oil prices. Prices rose almost from the instant they came to power, and this, of course, gave them the ability to institute all kinds of programs and things that, some of which were very necessary and popular, and others which maybe aren't so necessary and aren't so helpful. And it also has the effect, of course, of not always, but in these cases, of consolidating their hold on power, because they can kind of buy off opposition in some way. They can buy off support. But, and this is where it becomes problematic, only so long as prices are high or output remains high. And that's why kind of in Venezuela now, you read the New York Times today, actually, there's a story about all the power outages and things like that that are going on there. It's a very problematic basis for regime stability.
Hi, my name is Erica Razouk. I'm in the anti-corruption program at the Justice Initiative here, and our program focuses on corruption in sub-Saharan Africa related to natural resource extraction. So I first wanted to thank you very much for your very serious work and for your discussion here today. I'm happy to hear that Equatorial Guinea is on your mind. The Justice Initiative has filed two proceedings relating to Equatorial Guinea, one in Spain and one before the African Commission. Mm-hmm. I was also very interested in your discussion of the problems with using the term resource curse, because I think, as you said, it maybe makes the problem seem a little bit out of reach or unsolvable. I was wondering if you, in your research and as a writer, talking to people across countries, have come upon a better way to discuss the issues that may get us to understanding the complexities and moving closer to solutions, especially with a country like Equatorial Guinea, where maybe we're still at a point where we can turn things around.
You know, language is just so important in terms of framing issues and making people understand them on an intuitive, immediate level. And if I could go back to the beginning in the sense of when I wrote the book, I probably, and I'm still making this mistake, I probably would use the word curse a lot less frequently because you can get kind of a Pavlovian response in some cases, and an understandable one in the sense of people saying, but wait a minute, what are you talking about? You know, Sachs's research has been proven to actually have been kind of a little bit off base. He may have found a problem, but he didn't prove it with the data set that he actually used. So I think one of the things maybe, and I'm still violating what I'm about to say, is to not use the word curse. Peril is a good word. I try to use peril a little bit more. And I noticed, like, on your website, you now tend to have quotation marks around resource curse in some cases, which may be a good idea because you kind of need, which actually kind of, however, is problematic because then it kind of, like, throws into question whether or not there actually is a curse of any sort, whether you're talking about a universal law or just in particular circumstances. So maybe peril is a good word to use, but there are probably much better words to use or phrases to use. And I think maybe kind of getting away from proving the resource curse or a resource curse and just kind of shining spotlights on the problems and saying, okay, you know, oil is related to it. And not being overreaching. I mean, the biggest problem of and that's some of the problem, I think, with Sachs's original research was that he overreached in terms of the thesis that he had and the data set that he used. And so if you maybe just don't expose yourself to criticisms for trying to attribute too much to oil, like Nigeria is messed up because and only because it has oil. No, you know, oil has contributed to Nigeria's problems, and so let's just focus on what oil does and what we can do. So maybe those kinds of things, focusing on language and not being too extravagant and being very cautious, in fact, in what you claim, because there also is a problem that Paul Slovic is a kind of psychological researcher in Oregon, I think it is, and he and some other people have done really interesting research on the fact that, you know, these days, the bigger the problem is, the less likely it is that people will react. So actually, by trying to say, like, you know, there's a resource curse and they're all fucked, you know, you're actually kind of making your mission of trying to get people to pay attention and do something even harder. So the kind of the more specific and the more constructive and the more individual you can be. There's some research that's just wonderful where, like, focus groups are shown, like, you know, a picture of one child and told, okay, you know, if you give some money, this child will be saved, and they give lots of money. And they're given pictures of four kids, and they're saying, okay, if you give some money, these kids will be saved, and they don't give much money at all. And if you give them a picture of, like, 100 kids, forget it. You know, they're just going to go to sleep. So, which kind of, you know, gets to Stalin's old thing about genocide, which is, you know, one person's, you know, murder is a tragedy and, you know, 1,000 is a statistic. So I, as a writer, what I try to do is, even though I violate it by talking about curse every so often within proximity to the word resource, is focus on individuals, you know, the scenes, the places, the particular voices, and bring them alive, because I find most effective way to keep people interested and to illuminate problems, because statistics, they don't just kill narratives. I think they also do kind of, like, put people off in some ways, you know? So you have to use it all very... Does that help?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of wonder if there's any difference between oil and other resources, like having, you know, a large labor body or having, you know, financial assets or technology as resources, you know, what is it?
Well, yeah, there is, I mean, there is a special property to oil, which is that it's concentrated and its ownership is concentrated usually. I mean, America is somewhat of a different situation. Actually, there's a lot of private ownership of oil, which I think probably is a good thing in a country because then it allows a lot of people to have ownership, to have interest, rather than just the government or the ruling family. And that's where oil is special because it's not like, you know, farmland where you need people to farm it and where... And there's going to be private ownership of the farmland. I mean, in most of the countries that we're talking about, oil resources, oil, it's owned by the government. And that is, I think, just an inherent problem because of the concentration of the resource and the precedent for governments, ruling families, to claim total ownership of it. That's a particular recipe that you don't have with a lot of other resources.
Oh, hi, thank you. My name is Kara Hogue, and I'm just simply interested. Just want to say, I read a review of your book, and it actually made it to my list of things I have to buy soon. It seems excellent, and the review was very favorable. In Harper's recently, they had an article that touched a little bit on what you talked about with Jim Geffen and an elite group of people that deal with oil contracts and getting them. And I just wondered if you wrote about that or what you think of that and or if it's true, or if you had any experience there.
I think the story you're referring to is the profile of Eli Cowley, I think his name was, yeah. And that's a story that was written by Ken Silverstein, who is a fantastic investigative journalist who actually broke the whole Equatorial Guinea story, whatever it was, about 8 or 9 years ago when Ken was working for the Los Angeles Times. And that was a really interesting, really good story. I mean, all of Ken's stories are really good. He focuses a lot on kind of the ties between lobbyists, et cetera. You know, I find the whole kind of world of oil men and oil fixers and oil dealers to be fascinating because, like, this guy Geffen, who I mentioned, I mean, he's kind of a lovable rogue in a way, you know, because he's very honest. There's another guy I talked to named Brian Williams, and he's also in the book. And this is a guy, Brian Williams, who was a senior executive for Mobil in the former Soviet Union, and he was convicted of tax fraud related to some oil deals that he had negotiated on behalf of Mobil. And he spent 2 years in prison. And he got out of prison, was living in a halfway house, and I went and I interviewed him. And he was really interesting because, you know, it's very hard to get oil men who are currently working for oil companies to speak publicly about things honestly and even privately. But not only, obviously, had Brian Williams left the employ of Mobil, but he had served time in jail. So he was in a very kind of, I think, you know, slightly bitter, but also more honest frame of mind. And he said to me, look, you know, you guys might not like what it is that I do or what other oil negotiators do. But, and this is almost an exact quote from him, you know, if you only want us to drill for oil in London and Paris, that's fine. We'll be stepping over manure in the streets of New York because we're all going to be riding around on horses. And I don't excuse Brian Williams or Jim Geffen for illegal things that they might have done. They should not. There are laws and there are good reasons for these laws and we need to enforce them. But they were making a point, and this is where kind of like Eli Cowley comes in as well, is that like, look, you know, and there's a reason that these deals are being made and that, you know, governments are looking the other way or maybe not enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act as strongly as they might, or that the CIA is giving a wink while the Justice Department is not. It's because Americans want their gasoline cheap. Europeans want their gasoline cheap. And therefore, you know, if there's a choice between, you know, paying $2.45 at the pump for the cheapest gasoline possible or $2.75 a gallon at the pump for, let's say, fair trade oil, probably that $2.45 pump is going to be getting a lot of business. And so it's not just kind of the Jim Geffens and the Brian Williams, kind of the shiny baubles of corruption that we need to focus on. You know, there's a pipeline. They're part of it. And, you know, it kind of comes just directly back to us, you know, consumers in America. So just as kind of like I'm very critical of big oil, Chevron, Exxon, what they did in Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, et cetera, but they're just kind of part of it, and they're in some ways they're actors, they have agency, but, you know, they are also kind of consequences as well. I don't know if that answers your question, but okay.
So we have a question here, and then the gentleman there.
Hi, my name is Greg Beyer, and I'm an investor. Where do you think Saudi Arabia is in terms of their actual reserves versus their stated reserves?
I don't know. They say...
Because there are obviously substantial incentives for them to overstate it and to have overproduced, you know, during the last few decades.
Right. Well, this is the problem. You know, all of the OPEC members, their quotas, when the quota system was introduced in the mid-late 1970s, I forget the price year, the quota system was based on reserves. The larger your reserves were, the higher your quota was. And so all of a sudden, once that quota system was kind of imposed, boom, the stated reserves of all these OPEC members went up. And they haven't gone down since then. And they were never verified at the time, and they haven't certainly been verified since then. So Saudi Arabia, you know, in terms of like how much oil it has, they stated 264 billion barrels. You know, the BP statistical index, which kind of is used as the industry standard, you know, uses that figure as it does for all these others. And there has to be, and there should be a big asterisk by every one of those figures, which is this is according to unverified information from these countries. And I think that kind of the companies and the international organizations that use these figures should be making a much bigger deal of the fact that, hey, there's this asterisk and we need to be made aware of that. I'm not, you know, but for Saudi Arabia, I'm not so concerned about their reserves in a sense. I'm just more concerned about their production. I mean, you know, what are the trend lines in the reservoirs that they have in terms of the types of methods they're using for recovery, the amount of water that's coming out of the ground, et cetera, you know, they have a lot of oil, but how easy is it for them to get it out of the ground? And we don't know. So that, to me, is the more crucial thing. I forget about how much oil you have, Saudi Arabia. Just give me the production data for your fields, and that would be enough. And we're not going to get that ever.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Norbeck. I wanted to say thanks very much for your remarks today. They were really instructive and informative. I've done a little bit of work on issues similar to some of the ones you talked about today in Belize, actually. I was a Peace Corps volunteer down there. And, you know, Belize is a tiny little country, so it doesn't get a lot of international press. But it's just sort of opening up a lot of its public lands to exploration and extraction for a consortium of internationally held oil companies. And it's very preliminary, you know, not much has actually gone on, just seismic testing for now. Mm-hmm. But it's already sort of starting to trigger a fair amount of civil conflict among folks who would like to see the lands protected, you know, as national parks or indigenous managed areas, and those who say, we'll bring the development in, we want jobs, right? So I can really appreciate some of the civil conflict stuff you're talking about in Nigeria and other Latin American countries regarding, you know, competing priorities. My question for you is, you know, I know you're a journalist, so your priority is not making policy prescriptions, of course, but what role might you see, if any, for these, you know, developed oil-consuming countries in helping foster a peaceful transition toward decline in oil revenue for these countries who become so dependent on exporting it?
Well, I mean, Ecuador is a really interesting situation because, like, one of the proposals that's come out of Ecuador in relation to the Yasuni National Park, and there are people here probably know a lot more about this than I do, is that Rafael Correa, the president, has basically proposed, look, if the developed countries, or particularly America, would provide us with, and I forget the amount of money, several hundred million dollars, then we will not have any oil extraction going on in this national park. We need money, you know, and there is a global warming problem, so just provide us with the money, because we don't want to destroy our wilderness either. That money's not forthcoming. So, you know, what's going to happen in that area, I don't know. The potential for civil conflict in southern Ecuador, I went into this area where the oil companies want to drill. And it's a really tricky problem because I you know, got on a little Cessna and flew for about 45 minutes over just this wonderful, beautiful, untouched area of the Amazon and land in this little dirt airstrip. And then I spent a couple of nights in this area that's known as Sarayaku. And it was really revealing to me because the oil companies have been trying to do some drilling there, some seismic surveys, and they actually went in there without the permission of these local indigenous people one time a couple of years ago. And the indigenous people got out their spears and went out there and took the soldiers and the engineers hostage and got a promise from the government that they would not come in without permission again. However, in these communities, there's real division because some people say, like, look, you know, we don't want to have what happened in the Oriente, a disaster zone, happen down here. But the oil companies say, look, you know, we do it in a much more environmental way now, which actually is true, and, you know, we're going to give you money for schools and for education and things of that sort. And, you know, let's not be kind of like romantic about living in the rainforest. It is hard, you know. These people want medicine. These people want a better life. They do want some education. And so this one village that I was staying in, kind of the center of Sarayaku, the leaders were telling me, look, you know, we have to provide an alternative. We just can't, it's not enough for us to say no because we know that there's going to be environmental pollution and all kinds of problems, and that culturally it will be genocide because, you know, once the oil roads come in particularly, everything comes in after that, settlers and all that. But it's not enough for us to say no. We have to be able to provide an alternative. Now, this little community was beginning to do a good job. They had gotten some support from the Spanish government, so there were a couple of Spanish teachers there, and they had a couple solar cells to power a generator, and so they could kind of have instructional videos for their kids to watch by. But, you know, that's just one little community. And they were just barely eking along, providing their own people enough so that their people would kind of remain in solidarity against oil extraction. But there were all these other communities around them that, you know, were basically saying, look, you know, we know it's problematic for oil companies or any companies to come in here, but what alternative do we have? And, you know, when you're talking about alternatives, it is going to be kind of like investment from richer governments like ours. But then it becomes very complicated because, you know, just go ask anybody from the United Nations. I mean, spending development money effectively in these countries is really, really hard. We just, you know, need to try to do it and need to try to do it better than we have in the past and not give up. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
It comes really close.
Okay.
Because, Javis, I'm running Sustainable Development Media. Now, what if the unbelievable does in effect happen and the United States decides that in order to stimulate the production of alternate fuels is ready to tax carbon to a level that it makes the import of oil very expensive? Now, how do you look at the countries you are talking about when in effect their oil maybe cheap to produce, whatever, but it becomes expensive to buy?
So, so the question is that what effect
the
is this?
The question is really that when finally we get to the point that we price carbon,
right,
the CO2 emissions,
right,
to the level which it deserves,
right,
which means that the price of oil, gasoline,
right,
diesel becomes expensive to the consumer,
right, right,
which means that less will be bought.
Right.
So what is going to happen in the countries that you are describing?
Well, this goes back to, I think, one of the questions at the opening, and, you know, the answer is I don't know. You know, it could be in a country like Nigeria with less money coming in as a result of the oil, perhaps with less oil being bought, that indeed there's more conflict for the smaller amounts of money that's actually available or the smaller amounts of oil that's available to be bunkered or siphoned out of pipelines. I don't know. I mean, you know, there are going to be all kinds of problems. It's like, you know, just it's like with, you know, the kind of slogan about warfare, you know, the you know, battle plans, you know, fall apart once the first bullet is fired. I mean, it's the same thing with, like, okay, what happens, what are the impacts going to be if there is a carbon tax or if there is just a gasoline tax here of significant sorts? You know, what will happen in these other countries and how should we react to it? I don't know. I mean, there's going to be a lot of adjustment that we have to do along the way. But, you know, if we know that in order to survive this planet, just for the reason of global warming, that we have to reduce our use of fossil fuels, then we have to do that because otherwise we know we're not going to survive. And the problems that we're going to encounter along the way are going to be huge, and there are going to be, you know, bumps, and there are going to be problems, and there's going to be, you know, conflicts and perhaps worse violence in some places. And we're just going to have to, when that happens, attack it and try to deal with it as best we can.
Could you answer that actually it will be a positive thing inside those countries, that in effect Nigeria, for instance, might find itself in a position to do the right things?
Well, I hope so. And in the book that I write in the conclusion that, you know, if we reduce our need for oil, then hopefully these countries will be able to reset their priorities, reset their economies, and, you know, develop other industries outside of oil. I mean, Lee Kuan Yew, the kind of founder of modern Singapore, said, like, thank God we didn't have oil because it forced us to develop other industries. And so, you know, there's a hope that I would have, and one can see a certain kind of logic in this, that yes, you know, when governments and officials and individuals realize that, hey, the honeypot of oil is just like no longer there, or it's not going to be there in a couple of years, then they're going to start doing the really hard thing, which is developing other industries, developing their farming industries if they've fallen apart, et cetera, which they, one of the reasons they haven't done is because they've just been relying on oil or thinking that oil would be their savior. So I have that hope, but I have to be realistic that, like, well, in some countries, maybe there will be more violence before they get to that point. I don't know. You know, transition's going to be hard for us. It's going to equally be hard for these countries. If I can just, it's a separate issue, but I just, before I get out of here, wanted to mention it. I mentioned this to Karen before, in terms of transparency. One of the aspects of transparency that I've been throwing out there to people, and I wish that, and this is the perfect group for it, is sourcing. People, there's one guy who came up to me after a talk I gave in Seattle, and he said, you know, I got a crazy question for you. I said, go ahead. I've got a crazy family. He said to me, look, is there any way for us to know at the pump where the oil comes from? You know, if I knew it came from Equatorial Guinea or Kazakhstan or whatever, then, you know, maybe I would buy it. And, you know, I said to him, look, that's not a crazy idea at all. Traditionally, oil companies don't like to give out information about where the gasoline comes from that is sold at individual pumps. But there was actually a reporter for the Chicago Tribune named Paul Salopek, S-A-L-O-P-E-K, who about a year or two ago did a series, and he was able to trace from kind of the countries to the pump where the oil came from. And if you'll remember that with Kathy Lee Gifford garments, this is like 15 years ago, but also with Nike shoes, when consumers find out that the products they're buying are made in sweatshops or in, you know, countries where there's slave labor or something like that, they tend to react. I don't know if they would react with oil because it's easier to go without Kathy Lee Gifford shirts than it is to go without oil. But identifying, and this requires a lot of data mining and might require some legislation forcing companies to disclose proprietary information about, indeed, kind of like where the refined oil comes from that is at the pumps. But identifying, sourcing, so that people, consumers at the pump, know where their oil comes from. I don't know what effect that would have, but it could have an interesting effect in terms of making people aware and connecting them to this substance that they don't even see because, you know, they're just pumping it into their gas. They don't even see the gasoline, really. But connecting them to actually the countries of origin. And it's work that hasn't been done yet. And somebody, some organizations need to give it a shot because it could have an interesting effect. It could connect people here in America to Nigeria, to Equatorial Guinea, to Kazakhstan. I try to do that in my book, but, you know, my book's not going to be a bestseller. But if you can have, you know, at every pump in America, you know, using a Google map so people know or they're made to know or signs in front saying, yeah, this gasoline comes from Nigeria. Here's a little picture of one Nigerian child. it might make a difference. So that's a pitch I just wanted to make while I'm here.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time. We were slated to run until 2 o'clock, and we have surpassed that with this very interesting set of commentaries to add to your very, very interesting and illuminating book. I recommend it to everyone. It's an extraordinary repertorial job and a very complex subject with global implications. So thank you very much for spending this time.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.